Tim.
Okay, so I'm going to stop sharing my screen and give access to Rob. And just a reminder, that the Research Affiliates is the sub-advisor of the PIMCO Research Affiliates Emerging Market Value Fund. We've been invested for about 3 years. And so I'll let Sasha talk out of PIMCO and introduce and review the relationship between PIMCO and Research Affiliates before we turn over to Rob, who can explain to us what's going on with the value factor and how we should be thinking about that large bifurcation between the tech stocks really, you know, going gangbusters and utilities and banks and industries really lagging in a short period here. So Sasha, let me turn it over to you.
Great, thank you, and good morning to the Sisera team and board. I think I recognize many of you in the room, but for those I have not met yet, I'm Sasha Talcott. I'm an account manager in PIMCO's Newport Beach office, of course now in my Irvine home office. I have the pleasure of covering our relationships with the California public plans, including 16 out of the 20 SACRS plans. We've worked with Contra Costa County in various ways for 18 years, so I should pause here and just say thank you to this entire board and to the investment staff. We are deeply grateful as a firm to be working with you. And it has, county has a special place in my heart as well. I was actually my first client when I moved back to California 7 years ago, and so I've covered the relationship for 7 years at this point. I have the honor and the privilege today of introducing Rob Arnott, the chairman of Research Affiliates, and his esteemed colleague, Brent Ledbetter, a senior product strategist at the firm. Research Affiliates, as their name suggests, is a research-driven firm. They're a pioneer in the topic of asset allocation, as well as systematic equity strategies, of which the Research Affiliates equity strategy, which Sisera holds in the emerging market portfolio, is one. As their name suggests, Research Affiliates prefers and tends to put its emphasis and focus on the research aspect of the strategy, which means they have partnered with PIMCO for some of the more operational and implementation oriented aspects of this strategy. So as you think about it, the way to think about it is that this strategy is really driven by Research Affiliates, its intellectual property as the sub-advisor of the strategy, and that PIMCO is in this particular strategy more of a supporting role on the operations and infrastructure side. So taking you back to when Sisera originally underwrote this portfolio, and we're conveying our understanding here, and Tim, please correct me if we say anything incorrectly, but we understand that this portfolio sits in your emerging market equity sleeve. We're paired, the Research Affiliates equity is paired with manager TT International, and it was really intended as a portfolio construct, so TT being more of an active stock picker, perhaps a little bit more highly concentrated and maybe a little bit more growthy in orientation. Research Affiliates equity being a systematic strategy, a little bit more quantitative in nature, value oriented, and in particular, a little bit broader index exposure. So a pairing within the total portfolio. Let me, if no questions on that and the relationship between PIMCO and Research Affiliates, let me turn to Rob specifically, just to walk through the case for value, what has been going on with value recently, why we've seen value underperform, and our expectations going forward. But before we do that, let me pause and just see if any questions from the board up front.
Doesn't appear so.
Son, can we give Rob the presenter status, please, so he can present his slides?
Thank you very much. Should be popping up momentarily.
There we go.
Okay. What I'd like to do is spend a few minutes walking through recent market tumult. Tim did a wonderful job summarizing what's been going on year to date. And so I don't think we need to dwell long on that. But what I'd like to do is to open with a discussion of the role of value in your portfolio. value matters, valuation matters. Even growth investors, money managers who specialize in choosing growth stocks, care about whether they're paying above or below the likely future value of the stock. And so valuation is very important. It doesn't mean that value strategies will win all the time. There are times when value itself is getting expensive, and that is to say, not more expensive than the market, but a skinnier discount than usual. They're still out of favor companies. They're still unloved. They're still cheap relative to the market, but they're not very cheap. And when that happens, value can underperform. The opposite extreme also happens from time to time. At the peak of the tech bubble in 2000, at the trough of the global financial crisis in the first quarter of 2009, and again today, we've seen extraordinary spread between the pricing of growth stocks and the pricing of value stocks. And so the question becomes, when should we expect rewards from our commitments to value investing? Short answer to that is it's episodic. Long answer to that is that over long periods of time, value strategies beat growth strategies. Why? Because growth strategies are comfortable. You're buying what's loved. You're buying what everybody thinks is positioned to fare very well as a company. And they are better companies. But they're priced at a premium. And often that premium is too large relative to the future success that's likely. Tesla is a wonderful poster child for that right now. It's worth more than twice as much as the entire rest of the U.S. auto industry, and it's worth more than twice as much as the largest auto company in the world, Toyota, which incidentally has turned a profit every quarter, even during this crisis and the global financial crisis, and produces 40 times as many cars as Tesla does. So when you're looking at comparisons where a company 1/40th the size trades for more than twice the price, you have to ask the question, is this a bubble? And I think the short answer is, yes, we're seeing bubbles galore. And bubbles, it's dangerous to bet against them because they can continue longer than you expect and go further than you expect. But it doesn't mean you have to buy into the bubble stocks. Value, when it comes back with a vengeance, performing extraordinarily well. After 2015, when the RAE emerging markets strategy lagged the emerging markets index by over 8% in a bear market, it came back and won by 22% in the subsequent bull market, producing an 85% return in a 12-month span. 85% in 12 months.
Rob, I'm assuming it's okay to jump in every once in a while.
Absolutely.
I think it would be helpful, at least it would be for me, to talk a little bit more about how you determine what is value and what is growth. For example, I know the old definition was if they paid a dividend, they're now value. Are Apple and Microsoft value or are they growth? And what are you really using here as your differentiation between the two types?
Sure. We use multiple metrics. I have some material shortly that'll review that. But there's many definitions of value. The classic academic definition is price to book value. Boy, is that a narrow definition. Book value misses all sorts of things. It misses innovation. It misses R&D. It misses anything intangible is missed by book value, and yet it's the most widely used value measure. Before we get to the nature of our process and how we think about value, let's take a quick dive and see when does value work. We looked at the six bear markets in the last half century that were associated with a recession. There have been bear markets that weren't associated with a recession. The crash of 87 is a vivid example. There have been a couple of small bear markets that were associated with corrections that were associated with recessions. But there were six where you had both a bear market and a recession. So that's the relevant comparison. What do we find? Cap-weighted market, the top row on this chart, produces a positive return zero out of the six bear markets. Well, of course, that's the definition of a bear market. It's a down market, down an average of 32%. Value, if you use price to book value, winds up down 23%, a composite, more balanced measure, down 18% on average, and actually produces a positive return in two out of the six bear markets. That's a shocker. It wins in only three of the six bear markets. It beats the market in three out of six. It's a coin toss. Lots of people think they should embrace value as a way of winning in a bear market. It doesn't work that way. In a bear market that is the bursting of a bubble, and this bubble has yet to burst, when it's a bursting of a bubble, value always wins big. Big. But when it's a shock to fundamentals, when it's a macroeconomic shock, value stocks are hit just as hard as growth stocks, often more. The rebound after a bear market is when value wins. Six out of six rebounds, of course, the market is up. Average of 61%. No surprise there. That's a big move, but it's the first 2 years of a bull market. Value wins even more, up 85%, and wins in five out of six subsequent rebounds. So value is there to help you if there's a bubble bursting. Well, my goodness, we have a bubble right now. When is it going to burst? It's anyone's guess. I don't think it'll burst when the Fed is on the verge of throwing another $2 trillion of stimulus into the economy. But after that has played out and as COVID starts to wind down, I think later this year we could see that bubble burst. I'd hate to be in those bubble stocks when that happens. Now, if you take the bear market, the full period, that's the bottom box on this table, that's the bear market plus the first 2 years of recovery. And in four out of the six times, you've recovered the entire damage of the bear market. Two out of six, you haven't. After 2 years of bull market, that's interesting. And a composite-based value strategy wins in five out of the six bear markets plus recovery. So that's a very important part of the role of value in your portfolio. It wins in the recovery after a bear market. It's a coin toss in the bear market. And on average, it wins by 37% over the span of the bear market plus the recovery. That's 37% over 3 years. That's 1,200 basis points per annum compounded over a three-year span. What does this bear market look like? This shows the market peak on February 19 and the end of the first quarter with three illustrative value stocks, one from each of three industries. Starting at the market peak, trading at 14 times earnings, specifically 14 times the average earnings of the past 5 years. That smooths out earnings peaks and troughs. 14 times is not terribly cheap, especially for out-of-favor value stocks. They crashed in the COVID crash, falling by half. Three representative growth stocks, drawn from the fangs as illustrative examples, fell only 12%. Well, to be fair, they fell 25% and then recovered half of the loss, but in the span of just a handful of weeks. But look at the valuations. They went from 153 times earnings to 141 times earnings. Amazon, when people will look at this and say, you're looking at five-year trailing earnings. That's crazy for a growth stocks. What does Amazon's earnings 5 years ago matter? Okay, when Amazon reported its first quarter earnings at the end of April, they were trading at 111 times the trailing 12-month earnings. 111 times earnings. They've gone up 50% since then. They're now at 160 times trailing 12-month earnings. My goodness, we did a back of the envelope and asked the question, if Amazon grows tenfold in the coming decade and becomes larger than the entire retail sector in the U.S. and half as large as the global retail sector, how much would it be worth today? 70 times, not 160 times. So you'd have to have some truly extraordinary growth expectations off of a very large current base to justify those multiples. This is the problem with growth investing. You're choosing better companies, companies that are more profitable, companies that are faster growing. You're paying a premium, and if the premium is too large, a terrific company, and Amazon is a terrific company, can be a lousy stock. What about other factors? Multi-factor is popular. I'll just cut to the chase and say, looking at the first box, low vol, excess return, first in the green box, 6 out of 6 bear markets, low vol helps. The next box down, 2 out of 6 of the recoveries. Low vol actually beats a bull market in 2 out of the 6 recoveries off of bear market lows. And over the full period, it wins 5 out of 6 times. Quality wins 5 out of 6 times. Size wins 5 out of 6 times. Momentum doesn't. I won't go into details on that. Here you have 4 factors, value, which we already talked about, low vol, quality, and size, all of which work 5 out of 6 times in a bear market plus the first 2 years of recovery. Some of them, like quality and small cap size, winning in the recovery, as does value, and some of them, as with low vol, winning in the bear market itself. So they serve different purposes. But value, you'll recall, adds twice as much value over the full period, twice as much as any of these. So value's role in your portfolio is now. We've had a bear market. We may see a bursting of a bubble, which would make the value strategies that much more important. And whether this is the recovery off the bear market or if the market's giving us a head fake and is going to test those lows, we don't know, but we will see a recovery in the coming couple of years. Let's turn attention to the RAE strategy. What is the RAE strategy? Well, firstly, we select stocks from a starting universe using a set of signals that will indicate higher expected returns because of the cheapness of a company paired with its quality, paired with momentum. Is the company showing some signs of rebounding? You don't want to catch a falling knife. A value stock that looks cheap and is in free fall, watch out, it may be headed for zero. You don't know. Especially in this post-COVID world, there will be a lot of bankruptcies, and they'll be on the value side. So the critics of value investing have it right that value stocks are where we're going to see the carnage. But how much carnage? Will it be enough to justify a 10-to-1 spread in valuation between growth stocks and value stocks? Because that's what we have now. After the tech bubble, I never thought we'd see a spread as wide as 10-to-1. We're wider now than we were then. The spread between growth and value is wider than it was at the peak of the tech bubble, and we know what happened then. It's much wider than it was at the bottom of the global financial crisis, and we know that value led the way in that recovery. We then weight companies not by market capitalization, but by fundamental measures of a company's size. What are its sales as a percentage of all company sales in the United States or in the emerging markets in the case of this strategy? What's its cash flow? What are its profits? As a share of all profits of all publicly traded businesses, what are its dividends as a share of all dividends paid? What's its book value as a share of all book values in the marketplace? 4 different measures of company size, 4 different gauges for how big the company is. Let's weight the company according to its macroeconomic footprint. How big is the business? And then let's incorporate in that screens to adjust for relative valuation for quality and momentum to avoid the value traps, to avoid trying to catch the falling knives that a simplistic value model will find is its Achilles heel. This shows relative valuation going all the way back to our 2006 inception for the RAE emerging market strategy. The blue line shows that this is a value strategy. You can see the discount relative to the broad MSCI emerging markets index ranges from a high of 20%, a high valuation of just a 20% discount to the market, to a current discount, all-time record, extreme, 58% discount. Now, this doesn't come from us saying, let's now dive deep into deep value. No, this comes from the fact that we're weighting companies according to their economic footprint. And there are some companies in the emerging markets that are just as expensive as the U.S. FANG stocks. In emerging markets, they're called the BAT stocks, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. They're priced right in line with Facebook, Amazon, Tesla, you name it. And they are extravagantly expensive. The fundamental weightings say these are great companies. Let's go ahead and include them, but let's include them at their economic weight. Well, that's about 1/20th as large as the economic as the market footprint. The market, the capitalization weighted market, is a growth tilted investment strategy that is momentum chasing and popularity weighted. Why should we expect to get a great return from a strategy that focuses heavily on growth stocks, that chases momentum, and that weights companies based on how popular they are? That doesn't make sense as a long-term strategy. Now, what we find is that the bigger the spread between growth and value, the more deeply we dive into value. And that's shown on the green line. This shows how cheap we are relative to the emerging markets value index. If we were flat line at zero on that graph, that would mean that we owned a strategy that was exactly as value oriented as the emerging markets value index. Well, we've been up as high as a zero discount, but we're down to about a 35% discount relative to the value index. So when value struggles, we move into a deeper value tilt. Now, that'll work against us if value continues to falter, but this is the best way to assure that when that market turns, when value turns, we are deeply into value and respond in the snapback in a fashion that captures more than 100% of the value added by value in its rebound. We saw this in 2015 and 16. We saw this in 2008 and 9. In both cases, we moved to a deeply discounted portfolio and enjoyed a snapback that was much bigger than value indexes themselves. Take a look at 2008 and at 2016. You can see the during the drawdown, our excess return against the value index was zilch in 2008, 1,200 basis points in 2009. The drawdown in 2015 was 1.6% during the drawdown, and in the snapback was 1,800 basis points. And from the bottom day to 1 year later, we had an 85% return. So the rebound can be quite stupendous. This shows the track record over multiple spans, and it's a little daunting. We'll start at the right in the second quarter. The fund was up 16.7%. The emerging markets index was up 18%, so we lagged it. But we beat value by 286 basis points, even though value was losing. Over the past 12 months, emerging markets have been hit hard. The index down 3, the value index down 15, we're down 18. Why is that? That's because we moved into a deeper value tilt than the value index itself. You can see that again back on this chart. Over the last 5 years, return 60 basis points, the index 280 basis points, so we're behind the index, but we're half as far behind the index as the value index. Now that's really interesting because we've had a value tilt bigger than the value index and yet we underperformed by half as much. We beat the value index by 140 basis points per annum, which leads to one of the most important messages about not value relative to the market, but the REE strategy relative to value. And that is shown here. The rolling one-year returns relative to emerging markets value are on this upper graph. You can see periods of time where on a rolling one-year basis in 2008 and 9, we underperformed in some 12-month spans by as much as 6%. Ouch, that hurts. But then look at the snapback, 2,500 basis points at its peak. Then another couple of periods of time of disappointment interspersed with periods of modest outperformance. And the drawdown in 2015, notably painful because it was a bear market in which value was getting hit harder than the market. A lot of people buy value thinking it'll cushion the downside. It doesn't unless it's the bursting of a bubble. The aftermath was, again, 2,000 basis points or more on a rolling 12-month basis. Huge surges. Now, you put all of these together and look at rolling five-year returns. This strategy has never failed to beat the emerging markets value index on a rolling five-year basis. It's never failed to win. And right now, we're looking at value having been hit very hard, trading cheaper relative to the broad emerging markets than ever before in its history, including the tech bubble and including the global financial crisis. Why? It's because people know that in emerging markets, their health systems are lousy. Their infrastructure is lousy. They're being hit harder by the COVID virus and the lockdowns than any developed economy. But pardon me, how many people are remembering that emerging markets are used to adversity, that this is a once-in-a-century crisis for us, and for emerging markets, this is just another crisis. We had one 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that was just as bad. They shrug these things off, and the market is right now ignoring that. So what a neat time to be thinking about value in emerging markets. I also have some material that covers value relative to growth in the U.S. It's of a more academic nature. I'd be happy to give a 10-minute synopsis of that work if that's useful to the team. But before we get into that, let me see if there are questions.
Trustees, any questions or comments? No one's mic's lighting up?
Huh? Let me go back, Rob, to my earlier question on how do you determine whether a equity is value or growth. And I used two examples, Apple and Microsoft.
Sure.
And if you responded to that, I apologize, I didn't quite catch it.
I didn't respond specifically to the question of Apple versus Microsoft. How we define value is, if we're weighting stocks according to sales, cash flow, dividends, and book value, then our weight relative to the market will be based on the relative valuation. That is to say, if a company is at half the price-to-sales ratio of the market, it'll have twice as much weight in our portfolio as it does in the market. So we look at the relative sales to price, the relative cash flow to price, the relative dividends to price, and the relative book value to price, using a blend of those four measures, gauge how cheap the company is relative to the market. Now, this is an emerging market strategy, so it won't use Apple or Microsoft, but the U.S. strategy does. And what's interesting to note is that Apple is a big company with big profits and enormous cash reserves measured in the hundreds of billions of dollars. Well, that's a company that is not an expensive company priced to perfection. Microsoft is about two-thirds the size of Apple, and it's worth a little less than Apple at the last time I looked. but not much less. So it's priced at a premium multiple. It gets a reduced weight in our portfolio, but we don't kick them out. We don't kick out the growth stocks. We simply reweight them to their economic footprint. The other, we describe the FANMAG stocks. That's the FANG stocks plus Apple and Microsoft. We're underweight the FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, in a very big way, very severely underweight. But unlike value managers, we don't kick them out. We still own them. They're great companies. They're just not nearly as big as the market gives them credit for. Maybe they'll get there, but you're prepaying for that growth. Apple is the one outlier where we're actually overweight relative to the market because it's an even bigger company than it seems.
Any other trustee questions at this time? Okay.
Do we have time for a quick 10-minute synopsis of our more recent research on growth versus value?
Yes, we do.
Let me begin with this graph, which shows the performance of value relative to growth over the last 57 years. The blue line shows the performance of, if you invested $100 in value and your next door neighbor invested $100 in growth stocks, what's your relative wealth? And at the end of 57 years, you're 4.7 times as wealthy as your next door neighbor because value works. But wait a minute, if you'd stopped 13 years ago and just put it all into an S&P index fund, you'd be 9.5 times as wealthy. That's the magnitude of the drawdown for value over the last 13 years. It's been brutal. Now, this is using price-to-book value. We did that because this is a research paper, and in academia, price-to-book value defines value. It's a lousy definition. Any other definition you use would have made a new high in 2013, and again, perhaps, if for some measures, in 2017. Our own measures had their last peak in 2017. So this is really just a three-year drawdown, but it's a nasty one. Other factors have also had drawdowns, small versus large. The small cap effect, which was published back in the late 70s, has underperformed since 1983, 37-year dry spell. Low beta. Everybody loves low beta strategies, minimum variance strategies, low vol strategies. They're in a 30-year dry spell. Their last all-time high was 30 years ago, and they're miles from that high. Winners versus losers, momentum. There's a lot of momentum investors out there that think momentum is the greatest thing since sliced bread. In the 20th century, it was. Look at that run from 1963 to 1999. It's done nothing for you since then. It's back down to 1997 levels. So you're underwater on a 23-year basis. High versus low profitability, the quality factor. Folks love it. And look at that run. It's been wonderful with one severe drawdown, and that was during the tech bubble. But there's a problem here. This was published in 2013. It didn't exist as a factor before that. It's done nothing for you since 2013. So value is not unique. Any of these mechanistic factors can have dry spells. They can be long. So the question then is value dead now? There's a lot of narratives for why it might be dead, but let's go into looking at some of these narratives. Firstly, why does value win? It doesn't win because they're better companies. Profitability favors growth. The growth companies have higher profit margins and faster growth rates. No question about it. They are priced at a premium. And so some growth companies in any given year fall out of favor, fall out of the growth segment. And in so doing, they pull down the performance of the growth portfolio. And then they're replaced with a new high flyer, which may stay there or may itself fall out of favor. The value portfolio is the unloved, feared, even loathed companies trading at deep discounts. And every year, some of them become less out of favor, more popular, less shunned. and Rise out of the value segment, pulling up the performance. That's called migration. Now, if migration stops and you're just left with the profitability difference, growth would win. If the profitability difference disappeared and you still have migration, value would win by even bigger than it has historically. So we ask the question, have the engines for value's performance changed? This shows before 2007, before the value, the price to book value metric fell off the rails, you can see on the bottom right corner, in any given year, 68% of last year's big value stocks are still categorized as big value stocks. 32% migrate. They migrate out of that segment. 24% upgraded to neutral. 1% doubly upgraded to growth. And 7% downgraded to small. It's overwhelmingly upgrades. That's great for value. The red box sort of in the middle, the big growth box that says 78%, from 1 year to the next, 78% of big growth stocks are still big growth stocks. What about the other 22%? What happens to them? 13% downgrade, pulling down the performance into neutral. And 8% downgrade in a big way, all the way to small cap. So that's the downward migration for growth stocks. Has that changed in the last 13 years? Not really. Growth migration has diminished a little bit. You get, instead of 78% staying put, you get 82% staying put. But value's had more turnover than it used to, going from 68% to 66% staying put. What about the growth rates and the profitability? Growth defined using price to book value before 2007 had average profit margins, the ROE metric of profitability, of 17%. Are growth stocks growing faster than they used to? Are they more profitable than they used to be? No, they're less profitable. What about the growth rate? It used to be 14%, now it's 8%. They're growing slower. Value also has been hit, less profitable than it used to be, slower growing than it used to be. But for looking at growth stocks relative to value, the difference matters. The profitability spread seems to have widened a little bit, and the relative growth rate seems to have slowed a little bit. Net net, things haven't changed a whole lot. Now, we wrote a paper that was massively controversial in 2016 entitled, How Can Smart Beta Go Horribly Wrong? A lot of our competitors attacked us for that paper, but it really shouldn't have been all that controversial. We said, just like stocks can get expensive or cheap relative to where they ought to be, strategies and factors can become expensive or cheap relative to where they should be. The blue line we already saw, that's the performance of the value factor, value relative to growth. The orange is the relative pricing of value relative to growth. You can see at point D, which was the last peak for value investing in 2006, look over at the right. The pricing of value stocks was 0.25. What does that mean? It means they were one-fourth as expensive as growth stocks. 4-to-1 ratio. That sounds like a big spread. It's not. The norm is 5-to-1. Where were we at the peak of the tech bubble in 1999? We were at 8-to-1, between 8-to-1 and 9-to-1. Where are we right now? We're at 11-to-1. Growth stocks are 11 times as expensive as value stocks as of the end of June. We also have the issue that price-to-book value is deeply flawed. It ignores intangibles, patents, trade secrets, specialized knowledge, brand, reputational capital, and the list goes on. Book value doesn't capture any of that. What if, instead of saying, here's an R&D expense, let's say, here's an R&D investment in intangible assets. So instead of taking it out as an expense, we add it in to the book value as an investment, and then amortize it out over 10 years, because you wouldn't do a dime of R&D if you didn't expect to get your money back in a reasonable span, let's say 10 years. If you do that, how big is the intangibles base of a business? The blue line. Back in 1963, intangibles for the average company would have boosted your book value by about 30%. Today, it's about 100%. For value stocks, it's about 50%. For growth stocks, it's approaching 200%. This means that book value misses two-thirds of the assets of a growth company and one-third of the assets of a value company. That's huge. What happens if you adjust your book value for those intangibles and look at how value performs? Well, you get the orange line. This highlights the horrible flaws of using book value. You would have had a 13-year drawdown with a price-to-book value orientation going all the way back to 2006, a 13-year drawdown in which you underperformed your growth-oriented next-door neighbor by 55%. If you take intangibles into account, you would have achieved a new peak of relative performance not that long ago, early 2016, and you would have had a 4-year drawdown, not a 13-year drawdown. Yes, value still performed horribly and has still gotten very cheap relative to growth, but 4-year drawdown is a lot more palatable than a 13-year drawdown. For RAE, it's been a 3-year drawdown. For RAE, the last peak in relative performance was February of 2017. So that 3-year drawdown, painful as it is, can presage a tremendous rebound. Finally, final exhibit, the green dot here is where we were in 2007. This little mark here at about 0.13, that's where we were at the peak of the tech bubble. So we went all the way from there to the green dot in the space of just 7 years. A rebound for value that was stupendous. Value beat growth by 20 percentage points per year for 7 years. Then it underperformed for 13 years, taking you back down to the red square. I love this asymmetry. Could we go lower? Yes, anything is possible. What's the relative likelihood of recovering some of that lost ground versus losing more? I like those odds. I like those odds a lot. History suggests that when value gets this cheap, it has never failed in the U.S., in IFA, or in emerging markets. It has never failed to beat growth over the next 3 years, not once. That doesn't mean 100% odds going into the future, but if it's never failed to win in the past over the next 3 years, I think we've probably got 80% odds or better that the RAE strategy will win over the next 3 years, quite possibly by a very large magnitude. So that concludes my formal materials. Let's open it up to any additional questions and then move you back onto your schedule.
Any questions or comments? I'm not seeing anyone's, I'm not seeing anyone light up their mic, so I think we're good. Thank you so much, Rob.
You guys have been very generous with your time. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Take care.